just changing gears here. We've been doing a tantric retreat. This is just different style, so. So I guess this is when I have to talk. So, we'll see how we go. But generally, when we take teachings here, I mean, in Dharma, you've all been to teachings, there's a whole set of prayers that we say. And I thought, because this is kind of a limited time, and I'm not sure how long we'll take to get through the text. I mean, I'm sure there is enough time, but I thought to just kind of streamline it with, also because there's new people here, and sometimes for new people, just going on and on and on is a bit much for them. So I just thought, I just made this short page here that we'll do before our sessions, and it's just refuge in a mandal offering, and a very condensed form of the Heart Sutra, and then we'll recite some of Buddha Shakyamuni's mantras. And it's just to prepare our minds and to create the cause to be able to receive the teaching and hear it and use it and put it into practice. So, you know, everything we do begins and ends with refuge, really, because refuge is the heart of the whole path. You know, refuge is it's the beginning, the middle, and the end. I mean, we start by taking refuge in our future experience of enlightenment, and we continue to take refuge in that as it grows and grows and grows until we actually become a Buddha. And the actual refuge is the teaching, you know, and the most important refuge is the teaching on the nature of reality of emptiness. And we take baby steps towards understanding that, and we do that through creating the causes and conditions. And so saying these prayers of aspiration is one way to create the causes, because it's like I said last night, nothing comes without creating the cause, and so we have to generate the positive potential in our mind streams. Because just as in the material world, we see we need to create causes, you know, if you want to build a grow a garden, you have to plant a seed and water it and take care of it. And it's the same with our minds. It's like we all have the seed of Buddhahood, but we have to grow it, we have to take care of it, we have to preserve it, we have to not damage it, you know, we have to fertilize it every day. And that begins with taking refuge and realizing that we do have the potential for Buddhahood. Every single living being, not just human beings, but every single living being has a mind. And that means that mind has the potential to be completely free of obscuring karmas. And so we first have to understand that and believe that and understand the nature of mind, that mind is completely, in its absolute sense, just formless clarity and has the capacity to know things. And I think that... well, I'll get into that later, but what happens is, I guess I'm getting into it now, is that because mind, even though it's empty, it has the capacity to, it is aware, it has the capacity to know something. Because of that, rather than just letting that be a moment-to-moment awareness, you know, because it has it seems to have a sense of time to it, then over time, each moment to moment to moment begins to feel like something that's concrete and real, begins to feel like there's an agent, there's something really in here. And rather than just moment to moment, you know, bursts of awareness like sunlight just shining. I mean, I don't think sunlight has a sense of I'm shining. I don't think the sun goes, I'm shining, you know. But we, because we're aware, we think it feels like there's, you know, a concrete I'm shining, rather than just shining, you know, rather than just being awareness, it's I'm aware. And that's the cause of all the problems. I mean, I'm sure you've all studied some, but just that one little tiny thing of misperceiving the most basic sense of what we are and who we are. The most basic existential reality is the cause of all this problem. And because of that, we can't... Well, then what happens is then we get these things happen and we remember them. And then they're recorded, you know, somehow. They stay with us because we create habits based on our experiences. And those habits then become the filter through which we experience everything. So that's how personalities get created, and that's how karma gets created. Is instead of just letting it, you know, be, we have to put a label on it. We have to say this was good and this was bad, and now I'm going to be afraid of that, I'm going to want that, and I need this, and, you know, all this stuff comes from that. And so then those patterns go on and on and on, and so it becomes kind of a self-destructive thing, because it just seems that because we sense this I, and the thing is that anytime we get a little sense of emptiness because there's no I there anymore, it's scary. And so we don't go towards that. We go ever more towards more and more concrete, more and more concrete, more and more I'm, until we have countless lives of being an animal and being a spirit and being a human, and it's all. And each time around, we keep creating more and more of this matrix of this, you know, how our filter, of how we filter the random events, you know, that are happening in the universe, these random events that aren't completely random, because it gets more and more complicated as karma goes along. So then we have people we've known before, and we see them again, and it gets more and more complicated, till we're just sort of living in this dense matrix of concrete reality, when just like that, you know, just emptiness is just right there, you know. But we're so needing to be secure that we hold on to these things that make us not enlightened and harm others. And if you think about it, you know, each one of us does that. And some of us do it in maybe more virtuous ways than others, because we have some other imprints of like being good, you know. But if you think about where the human race is right now, it's actually the whole why we're destroying ourselves. You know, it could be quite, you know, in the next 50 years, you can't live on the planet anymore. Because it's that same mind that can't see beyond itself to realize that, you know, we're destroying the habitat, our own home, you know. And it's that very same root of samsara, to help us understand, you know, why can't we stop? Why can't we change our habits, you know, and stop flying and build, you know, alternative energy and do all these things that we have the capacity to do? It's the same reason why when someone yells at me, I yell at them back. It's the way humans are, you know. We have 5 contaminated aggregates controlled by delusion and karma. And it works on the microcosm, ourselves. But now we see the effects on the whole planet of having a human mind and a human body. It's like what we're seeing now is the big samsara. But in actual fact, we're walking around like that all the time. We're constantly creating the cause for our own demise, by our own lack of attention to the fact that it's just a moment-by-moment reality, and that we experience, based on our past experiences, without any thought of realizing that what I experience is just filtered through my past awareness. So that's why we blame everybody else for what's going on outside of us. Everything that happens to us is because he did this to me. She did this to me, you know. And so that's kind of the next step, is that once there's a sense of an I, then we have to cling to that. And then that, you know, you've heard all this before, but that's what self-cherishing is. It's a need for safety. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be safe. We should be safe. It's just that due to our ignorance, we're looking for safety in the wrong place. You know, we're looking for safety in making things concrete and hard and a box, rather than realizing that the real safetiness and what real refuge is refuge in your ultimate nature. You know, the real refuge is in the fact that there isn't any place that's safe. The only place that's safe is when you create a stable mental inner space that's the fusion of love and emptiness, which is what real refuge is and what your true nature of mind is. But because we're so, and it's not anybody's to blame, it's not anybody's fault, nobody's bad, you know, we have to really get that clear. There's nothing wrong with us. It's just our mechanics. It's just how human evolution animals are. We have 5 contaminated aggregates controlled by delusion and karma. It's nobody's fault. We're not bad. It's just that everything we experience, we filter through our eyes, ears, nose, whatever the rest of them are, eye, ear, nose, taste, touch, and mind. Everything's filtered through that. And because the way our mechanics work, you know, the way the mind works, you know, we see something, it appears to be real, so then we think it's real, you know, it's just the way it works. And so what we need, what our job is to, just for a little while, maybe suspend that belief that's how it is, you know, that cup is a cup out there, you know, and begin to entertain the fact that, well, you know, maybe that's based on just my eye sense seeing it that way. It's just on my, you know, ear sense hearing it that way. You know, but it's not really how it is. And that's all we need to do. But the habit is so strong of needing to, you know, oh, I'm real, you know, that we don't do it. Even after 30 years of trying, still, it's really hard to get there, you know, or 40 years or lifetimes, you know. And that's where refuge comes in, because if you really, really can take refuge and have some sense of not blind faith but certainty that by following these methods you will get to another sense of me that's not tied to these, to this delusional sense of you know, I'm real, and that's self-destructive. You know, you can see it's, we're killing the whole planet, you know, or at least the possibility for mammals to live on it. Because we can't stop grasping, you know, even though we know better. You know, we know that in all of our lives, you know, how hard it is to stop the habit. Even if we just want to stop eating cookies, it's really impossible, you know. So we need to, and what prayer is about, prayer, the refuge prayer, you know, it's just setting a really strong intention that I want to become something different. It's how we create the cause, how we make something different. Is first we have to do it in imagination. The same way we're going to build a house. You're in your mind, you think of the house first, you know. And so the prayer, a prayer is like, you know, building the blueprint for your future, what you want to be, you know. So when you pray to, it's not because, you know, there's some holy being out there that's going to, you know, rain down fairy dust and boom, you know, you're changed. It's because you are creating the cause from the inside out to change by making that strong request, you know. And then the other thing that Buddhism gives us, if it gives us methods to build up, to, if you think of it, the analogy of a garden, you know, to fertilize that garden so that, you know, our prayers are like we're planting the seeds, you know, we're always planting those seeds, but we have to create the causes and conditions for the seeds to ripen. And that's where the idea of merit comes from, you know. I'm not sure that's such a great sonam in Tibetan. I don't know what it really means because I never studied Tibetan. But I like more the idea that it's creating, it's the karmas that create that will bring to fruition the prayers that we make. You know? So we have to fertilize that mind so that it has the power to make those changes, you know? And one of the most important things we need to develop, besides prayer and merit, is this idea of recognition, you know, what happens when we, how do we begin to change those habits? And the key is through recognizing our thoughts. And this is why meditation is so important, and why just reciting prayers over and over and over again isn't going to make you change. The only way you change is by developing what my friend, our friend John Landau called, and he might have learned it from somewhere else, but the mindfulness muscle. You know, you have to build it up, just like you would build up swimming muscles. You know, that habit of recognizing what's coming in your mind. You know, because most of the time a thought comes, we just do it. You know, we're just constantly just reacting to our environment. You know, just even reacting to our inner environment, we just react to the thoughts that are pouring out of us. You know. But what we do through meditation is learn to be, there's a little awareness that's going, oh, here comes this thought. And so then, and the more you do simple breathing meditation or mantra recitation, you know, you begin to see, in the beginning it's just thought, you know. But after a while, there'll be a little gap between the thoughts. And then the more you learn to relax in your body, which is why I emphasize that so much, then you create this gap, and you can just hang out in the gap, and then you can begin to see when a thought comes and when a thought goes. And so then when and the more that gap grows, and the more you begin to develop this sense that I'm not my thoughts, because that's the other thing, we're completely oneness with our thoughts. You know, we don't even recognize that there's a subject and an object. We're just running with whatever's happening. And when you begin to meditate, you begin to separate, oh, there's something thinking about that, you know. And so when there's something thinking about that in the beginning, there's this, you can begin to make this little bit of space. So this I gets to see that I'm about to think that, which is going to make me do that. And so then you can put the brakes on before you do something. And change that. And that's what mind training is. Mind training is putting the brakes on, you know, and shifting between a habituated reaction to the possibility for something new, right? And so what this teaching is about is giving us a guideline of how we can, once we get the habit of being able to put the brakes on, okay, what are we going to do instead of what our natural inclination is? And that's why we need to learn it and study it, you know. But, and then that's more like the relative bodhicitta of how we change within, you know, what we can do about our behaviors. But what goes along with it is also, okay, once we get the separation between the subject and object and there's that gap, then you can also kind of like let that gap turn around and be the subject too, because ultimately the subject, instead of being this I, has to open up into that sense of spaceless, loving awareness. And that's the ultimate bodhicitta. And so then the two of them together is how you get an inner being, which is the definition of a Buddhist. Buddhism is was termed by the English, you know, Buddhism, you know, but it isn't an ism. It's just a science of how you create that space in your mind so that then you're free. You're no longer in, you know, stuck with who you think you are, because you're not that. It's just all you are. You know, it's just a series of the labels that you gave yourself and everybody else gave you, and you stick to that, you cling to that. Which is why, I mean, the meditation we're doing really fast in the morning, but if you get the technique, why you need to spend some time with just your own stuff, so that it's creating the cause to dissolve those habits we have about who we are. Because that is the greatest danger. You know, I mean, we can take, you know, some of these ridiculous people that seem, you know, like, okay, my president, you know, our president, you know, everybody can see. But we're no different. You know, we just have a different set of delusions. We just have a different set. And, you know, and maybe if he could see better, you know, maybe he wouldn't behave that way. You know, he probably means well. It's just that those are, you know, that's how he was raised. That's how he see. That's his view. But we all have that view, which is why we can develop equanimity, because just because, you know, I think mine's better, it doesn't mean it is, you know. Everyone is the same in that everyone wants to be happy, and everyone has a batch of preconceived notions through which they perceive the world, which is how they operate in the world. So if we learn to see people like that, you know, then we can then we realize we're all the same, and then it's not the person that we have trouble with, it's just their views, who they feel they are, because their real self isn't that at all. You know, their real self is just this empty being inside that, if it knew about enlightenment, would definitely want to go there. But they don't know about enlightenment, so instead they need power and money, because that makes them feel safe, you know. And so what we're looking for is the ultimate safety, the ultimate place of refuge, which is our own inner being. And the teacher, the guru, the only reason the guru is there is to show us that. It's not because the guru needs to be God, and the guru needs to be worshipped, and the guru needs to be chased after, and the guru needs this and that. The guru doesn't need anything but for us to practice. You know? Because they have completed the path, and they are here only to shine back to us that what they spent, you know, I don't know how many lifetimes, to acquire that sense that I'm talking about, that real refuge that, you know, there's nothing here. And there's nothing here other than the supreme love for all beings. And when that is all that's there, then it manifests naturally. Naturally, beings help others. And so that's why, you know, which it was saying over and over again, we say, you know, become enlightened for all sentient beings. Because everything we do, you know, creates causes, and so we want to create that cause. We want to become a great being that shines this light on any other being that they come into contact with and lets them know there's something other than I need to be safe. You know, I need to hold on to my eye because that's all I know. And it gets passed down from generation to generation to generation. I mean, your mom, you're inside the womb. She's going, I. And for a little while, it's me and my baby, you know, my. But then, you know, I keep quoting John Lennon. Then there's that other song, I, me, mine, you know, all through the day. I, me, mine. So that's what this teaching about is, to begin to look at that I, me, mine, you know, and how that gets us into trouble and how we turn that around by beginning to think about you, but the only thing about that is it's that it has to be done from a sense of well-being within yourself, because when that is not whole, you know, when our sense of self is still there just comes a great danger that we give too much. You know, if you go, oh, I'm going to become a bodhisattva, I'm going to keep giving. Well, but if you don't have a sense of what your own needs are, which I think Tibetan people just have, you know, they don't. It's okay for them. I don't know about it anymore. But so it's not so much of a danger that we end up getting really burned out or getting in codependent relationships and destructive situations. Because a lot of people in the West can't distinguish between a healthy situation and an unhealthy situation. And they meet the Dharma and it's all about, oh, I'm going to give to others. And they'll stay in an unhealthy situation because they think they're giving. But in actual fact, they're just destroying themselves. So then in the end, they can't really continue to give. So we have to be careful about that, which is why what's important is to begin to understand what our particular matrix is, you know. We need to understand our particular psychology and look at those and look at it until, and work with it until we feel when we think of I and we sit here and we're sitting here by ourselves, it's a happy feeling. Because so many of us in the West, when we sit here, if we really let ourselves be quiet, I mean, one of the reasons we can't be quiet is because when we sit here with ourselves, it's not a happy place. We feel shame, we feel regret, we feel unworthy, all these things that we, voices that we've allowed to become who we are, and those things need to be released before we can really engage in giving to others. And so this text doesn't talk about that, but I mentioned it last night and I'll mention it again today, that we have to be careful, you know, when we these teachings that say, you know, put all the blame onto one. I think we don't really want to use the word blame, you know. I think a lot of these translations need to be retranslated without this kind of shaming filter throughout the teaching, because it's there. I see it in the books I read, you know, because it doesn't serve us at all, you know. Because what the teaching is that what it's trying to point out to us is that it's our own perception that causes us harm. There's nothing on the outside. But that doesn't mean that we should be blaming ourselves or that we're bad because of that. It's just the mechanics of how it works, you know. Because, yeah, I mean, if we think about the nature of the universe, you know, the nature of the universe in one sense, you know, if we take it down to what we've learned in science, you know, there's just, you know, atoms, you know, there's just protons and neutrons and electrons, and then they're the building blocks. But if you break it down to those little tiny pieces, then that helps us to understand emptiness to a certain extent, and that it's just. And then even, you know, when they're trying to find, you know, the nucleus of the atom, they can't find it. It's empty too. It's emptiness. You know, what the scientists have come up with is emptiness. Like there is no real building block of the planet, you know, of the world, of the, you know. It all, when they're trying to find, you know, where the proton is, it moves whenever they think of it. So there is mind, which we scientifically don't really understand yet. But from the Buddhist point of view, and we'll get into that later, you know, everything out there is empty, and it arises in dependence upon the mind. But the mind is empty too. So if you can kind of suspend everything, just let everything go into that idea that everything could just like dissolve, and that. Then because of the movement of mind, it then takes form and shape. You know, we always read the Heart Sutra, you know, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Well, they're two sides of the same coin, but the emptiness bit is always there. So if we understand that, then we can then understand that when we are saying, you know, put all the blame on the self-cherishing, it's not because, you know, I'm a bad person because I've got self-cherishing. It's just that because of our ignorance, because what I said in the beginning about mind, because mind, even though it's empty, it's moving from moment to moment, it appears to be something. And so then it appears to be something out there and something in here. But that's the mistake. It's not because we're bad. It's just we have faulty mechanics. You know, it's just the way the human mind is. And so if we think of it that way, and the main thing to get is that everything I perceive is a product of my own imagination, that's why we all experience things differently. You know, I mean, we agree on lots of different things. I mean, of course, you know, we all see the same house, hopefully, you know, I don't know. Did you ever think about that? Do I see the doorknob the same way you see the doorknob? We all disagree it's a doorknob, but I wonder, you know. Did you ever think when you were a kid, is the color blue the same color blue that somebody else sees the color blue? We'll never know. We just all agree on that label that that's blue, but who knows if my blue is your blue? You know? It's all empty. But we do live in this world and we do have this stuff. So our job is to stop believing in so much that it's real, and that's how we can change, and that's how we can heal, is to know that everything is dependent on how we perceive it. And so that means that everything is changeable. And so, you know, the more we can work on our own developing flexibility, which comes from that, what I spoke before about meditating enough so that you have that gap, so that then you can have a tiny bit of space between the action and the reaction. Because that's all Dharma is learning to react differently to what karmically presents itself to you. It's basically all it is. And it's all about getting the tools. First, how to create the space so that we have a choice of how to react. And that comes through just simple meditation. And then knowing, having the different tools that tell us with our, you know, intellectual relative mind, that what is a new narrative I can put on that experience that's going to take me to enlightenment and not harm the person I'm interacting with or the situation I'm interacting with. It might just be a situation that you need to transform. And it really works. I mean, like I said, about even to the point where you're getting, someone can be beaten up and their mind training is so strong, you know. But at least we can get to the, we may not get to that point in this life, but at least we can get to the point where whatever comes to us in our life, you know, whether we lose a job, we lose a partner, we lose a child, you know, we don't like the weather, whatever it is, you know, we're able to make that a positive experience through mind training, through understanding emptiness, through then taking these incredible teachings that come to us through Atisha, through Buddha, of giving us all the tools we need to transform cancer and AIDS. And we know people who do. I mean, they don't have to be Buddhists, but there's some incredible people who manage to shift and turn. I'm sure your experience in Ethiopia and different places, you know, you see some people who manage trauma much better than others, you know, and it's just because their particular matrix of how they perceive things is slightly different than somebody else's, you know. And so if we understand that we're all connected to everybody else, then the more we work on ourselves, the more we're helping everybody else. And I don't think there's enough time to save this planet. but maybe there is. I shouldn't be so, you know. Maybe there is. You never know. You know? There's that that book called The 100th Monkey. Did you ever hear that book? Do you guys know the story of The 100th Monkey? You probably do. Well, we have time. I'll tell it. I think this was popular in the early 80s, I think. And it's the story of an anthropologist or an animal biologist, I guess, who was working on a small island in Japan. I can't remember if it was a he or she, because I haven't thought of it for a long time. But they noticed, they'd been going for years to study this population of monkeys. And they noticed that one time, this mother monkey figure out how to crack open a nut. I think that's what it was cracking open a nut to be able to feed that nut to her child. And she taught her children and they taught their children until it got to be 100 monkeys on the island. It must have been a few thousand monkeys. But once the 100th monkey learned how to do it, immediately all the monkeys got it in the next generation. So there is hope, you know. Maybe if we each become that one of those monkeys that's transforming our mind, then, you know, if you get this critical mass number, then maybe the whole human race will change. And I know that, remember the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the Beatles guru? I know that he believes that, and he's taken a bunch of young people and are training them with that idea in mind, that if he can get a few thousand yogis, then maybe the world would change, you know. So that's that's a long reason why we take refuge. Because refuge is the key to it all, you know. Just having, you really have to have not just certainty is the word. I think it's better than faith. Certainty that with doing these practices, we can get to that place, you know, not only for ourselves, but to share to others. And, you know, and also just the fact that if we can just be more at ease and less addicted to the sense pleasures of this life and able to turn things around, it affects everybody around us. And then also they begin to notice and see, wow, this person, you know. And then you can, so we really need to teach by example and live by example. And the only way we get that is from real meditation, because it's only meditation that we get to create that gap. And also have the inspiration. There is something to receiving blessings, you know. There is something to this, to prayer, you know. They've proven it, you know. And I don't know what the science of it is, but I'm sure there's some reason. You know, there's something that happens when you communicate with a vision of you know, the higher self, however you want to say it. You know, Buddha, Guru, Jesus, doesn't matter, you know. But it does kind of align you with the lineage of those beings who have received that. And I think it does have to do something with quantum physics and the fact that we're all interconnected. It's a bit like, the way I understand it, it's like there are radio waves out there in the world, everywhere now. There are radio waves everywhere, radio stations broadcasting. But when we turn our channel to, you know, 94.1, we get that channel that we want. And so when we take refuge, we're like, oh, I want the Buddha channel here. And so then you can download, you know, the blessings of the Buddha through that rate, through that system of waves that for thousands of years the Buddhas have been putting into our thoughtosphere, you know, the sphere of human thought, which exists. I mean, we haven't proven it yet, but definitely exists. How else could you? Everyone knows when someone's thinking about you. You know, your friends call, oh, he's just thinking about you. Doesn't that happen? Mm-hmm. It's because we're connected in thoughts, you know. And so that means that those lamas, those lineage, which is why lineage is so important in Tibetan Buddhism. You know, you kind of wonder why in traditional teachings we have to recite the lineage lamas, you know. Because what you're doing is you're building your radio tower so that you can connect with that lineage and connect with that specific group of blessings that you'll bring into you, you know. So I think that's okay for an introduction. What do you think? Okay. So we'll take refuge and do the mandala offering. And the mandala offering is about creating the cause, creating enough potential in your mind to receive the blessings. And so in ancient India, they thought that, you know, the center of the universe was Mount Kailash and Mount Meru, where they have all this, you know, cosmology. And, oh, about 30 years ago, the Dalai Lama says we don't need that anymore. But we still do it. I'm not sure why. And a lot of Tibetan Geshe's believe that's really how it is. So, which may be why these holiness want science taught in the monasteries. But this is a really good thing about Tibetan Buddhism. There is no dogma, really. I mean, what His Holiness says is as soon as science has proven something to be untrue that the Buddhists believe, we change it. You know, it's not like we have to stick to, you know, Adam and Eve. If evolution has shown something different, well, if we can see the stars with the telescope, we don't have to believe that it's Mount Meru and the four continents anymore. So I just use it as a base to offer everything, you know. So you just offer everything in the universe, and you can offer especially all the things, all the material things that you love, because it's a way of letting go of our grasping at material stuff. You know, so if you particularly love cars, you know, you can offer a bazillion cars. Or if you particularly love a type of food, or if you particularly love clothes, or if you particularly love shoes, or if you, you know, whatever it is, you can offer those things up, and it helps you to change that habit. And then with the inner offering, we offer everything we're attached to, everything we have aversion to, all our ignorance. So we just, it's just like we just want to get rid of it, you know. So we offer it to the Buddhas and with an open heart, and they gladly take it because they know it's empty anyway. But we don't. I mean, we might know it intellectually, but boy, not down here. You know, so that's a really important thing to do. Oh, I don't have the mantra there. You might want to, most of you know it, but after you say it, there's a thing that says Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayami. I'll write it somewhere. You can, if you don't, who doesn't know that? Oh, okay. Well, then I'll
show them after in the book.
Yeah, I'll show you in the book, and then you can copy it out of the book. I wonder why that's not there. And then usually in teachings, we recite the Heart Sutra. And this is a super abridged version of the Heart Sutra. And it's a homage to the mother Prajnaparamita, who is just a human form of emptiness. I thought about it the other day. I thought, it's a bit like God. You know, like, I don't think a lot of contemporary theologians really think that God is a being in the sky anymore. I think God is more like a universal interconnectivity of, but more like emptiness, you know. But because we're humans, it's kind of nice to have a human form, I suppose. And so in Buddha, it's a female. It's a Prajnaparamita, the mother Prajnaparamita, because she is the mother of all wisdom. So this is I never thought about that till the other day, about it being, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems a little bit like that. I look at her because she's like, I figure she's authority over there. I don't want to put anything on you there, Barbara. But anyway, I'm just kind of joking. So it's actually an homage to emptiness, you know, in the form of the mother of the three times Buddhas, because emptiness is the mother of the Buddhas. That's how we get to Buddhahood, is through understanding emptiness. And everything we do is to do that. You know, they talk about, you probably heard the two wings of the bird. You know, we have two ways to get there. You know, the left-hand side is emptiness, the female side, and the right-hand side is the male side, which is all the teachings on how to develop compassion, which is all the rest of the long room, basically. You know? And so, what really takes us there is being able to let go of complete conceptual everything. But it has to be the right letting go of concepts, not just into space or whatever, which is why we have to study. But for the purposes of this retreat, because this is going to be more experiential, we don't need to get too much into the study and the philosophy of emptiness. For now, we'll just relax into a spacious feeling of awareness, and that's close enough for now. And the more you study, the more when you relax into that space, it becomes more clear what that is. So I really encourage you to study, but we will go into it some here, but not a lot. So and then we say Tai Ta Om Muni Muni, just to bring in the blessings. So if we visualize, you know, the objects of refuge, it could be Mother Prajnaparamita in the heart of Buddha. That's kind of a nice way to think of it. Then when we say Shakyamuni's mantra, we visualize that, you know, the blessings of emptiness and bodhicitta are pouring into us and getting us ready to receive whatever we're going to study. And this is particularly nice for those of us in New Lama Yeshe, because he always started his teachings with that. So for me, it's kind of like connecting with my teacher to do that, so that I say the right things. Yeah, so I won't explain all this at the beginning, but it has to happen the first morning, you know. So let's start with refuge and bodhicitta. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, until enlightened I seek refuge, through giving and other perfections, to aid all may I become Buddha. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, until enlightened I seek refuge, Through giving and other perfections, to it all may I become Buddha. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, until enlightened I seek refuge. Through giving and other perfections, to it all may I become Buddha. So this has a tune too. I think this is from Rob Preece. So you can just follow along with me, because it's it opens the heart to chant these prayers rather than just say them. The ground is blessed with scent and with flowers strewn, adorned with Mount Meru, the four lands, sun and moon, transformed as a pure land, and offered. May all wandering beings enjoy this Buddha land. All those objects of mine's three poisons, coveted, friend, foe, and stranger, body, wealth, worldly pleasures, without a feeling of loss, I surrender. Receive them, please, and free all beings from their bondage. Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayami. That just means, please accept this offering. And then homage to the wisdom essence of the Heart Sutra. This is from the Chit practice. This is also Rob Preece's version. Beyond speech, thought, expression, wisdom gone beyond, unborn, unceasing, with the very nature like space, discerning transcendent wisdom's sphere of awareness. Homage to the mother of three times Buddha. So we take a minute to look at the nature of thought, of emptiness, beyond speech, beyond thought, beyond expression. Like the reflection of moon and water. Like the waves in the ocean. Thoughts are like the waves in that they're not separate from mind. Thoughts are in the nature of mind, and mind is in the nature of emptiness. Like clouds in the sky. T- Tayata Om Muni Muni Mahamunaye Soha. Tayata Om Muni Muni Mahamunaye Soha. Tayata Mahamunaye Soha. Tayata Om Muni Muni 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 Mahamunaye Soha. So, Training the Mind in 7 points by Geshe Chikawa Yeshe Dorje. We got 5 minutes left, but that's all right. So this mind training was brought to Tibet by Lama Atisha. And he was the extraordinary teacher that brought all these, the Lam Rim that we study, and basically everything we study in the sutras and some of the tantras. And he learned it from his teacher, Sirlingpa. And Atisha was an Indian, and Sirlingpa lived in Indonesia. And he heard about this lama that had all the secret bodhicitta teachings that I guess had been lost in India by that time. He lived about in the 11th century. I think it was 11th century, might have been 10th, but I think it's the early 11th century. And so he went through great hardship to get to Indonesia. It wasn't that easy to travel back then. He went by boat, and I think it took almost a year to get there, either 9 or 12 months. And there were big shipwrecks, and apparently he was a big, Atisha was a devotee of Tara. And he had a vision of the 21 Taras when they almost were shipwrecked, and the 21 Taras came into the sky and calmed the seas, and he made it to wherever it was in Indonesia. I don't know, maybe it was, yeah. And you know, they have that big, Indonesia used to be a Buddhist country before the Muslim invasion. There's still relics around the place. And so then Atisha, I won't take the time to go into the story, he learned from Sirlingpa, and then through also great hardship on the king Yeshe Oa, who gave up his life for Atisha to come to Tibet. That's how strongly he wanted the Dharma to come to Tibet to help the Tibetan people. So Atisha came, and he, even though it shortened his life, he came to Tibet and gave the teachings to Drontampa, his disciple, who was a layman, who was his main attendant. And Drontampa actually became the first Dalai Lama later on in a few incarnations later. But he passed them on to, I think it was Geshe Sharawa, who gave them to Geshe Patowa, who gave them to Geshe Langri Thakpa. And Geshe Langri Thakpa was the one who wrote 8 verses for training the mind. And then Geshe Chikawa was searched, and they were very secret teachings. They weren't widely well known. And so he searched everywhere to find these teachings, and he finally received them. He, of course, was grateful, and so he expanded it into a little more detail so that people could practice it. And The reason the Tonglen practice, which was the taking and giving that we were doing this morning, it became so popular all over Tibet is that at that time in Tibet there was a great deal of leprosy. And he taught it to the lepers and they started getting well. And so people were amazed by that. So what was this healing method that was healing the lepers? And it was this. And so it's become probably the most popular teaching in all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. You can probably, even in English, there's probably 10 books out there now. The one that my first one was actually one of the first Dharma books I ever bought, which was some advice from a spiritual friend. And I recommend that. It's Geshe Rabtun, who was Lama Yeshe's guru, many of our gurus' guru. It's his commentary. But there's also this book. I don't know if you can get this book anymore, but it's also really good. Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. It's the text from Namka Pel, who was one of Tsongkhapa's students. So this is 500 years old as well. But it's translated into English. And I don't know if you can get these books anymore. I'm not sure. It's the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. Probably. This one came from Nepal. And so we'll just start it. We'll just read the first bit, and then this afternoon we'll go over it. But we'll just read the first few lines, and we can read it together. It says, where it says, homage to great compassion. The essence of nectar-like instruction is transmitted from Sirlingpa. It is like a diamond, like the sun, and like a medicinal tree. The meaning of the text shall be known. The development of the five degenerations will be transformed into the path to enlightenment. To keep looking at the schedule. I think we stop at 10:30. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, we better stop. So then, maybe we'll just stop and we'll take a break for 15 minutes and we'll do the dedication at the end of the meditation. Mm-hmm. And so it's nice to try to end this break time because it's only 15 minutes for a tea break, isn't it? Yeah. So try to kind of begin, if there was any benefit in what I said, just kind of think about that. You know, don't just let when you're in retreat, the most important thing is to keep your mind in retreat. Don't at the break time think, oh, now's my time to think about other stuff. You don't want to think about other stuff. So when you catch yourself, you know, going off to, you know, what's happening here, what's happening there, try to bring yourself back into the topics that we're thinking about, to focusing on your breathing, to doing the Tonglen practice. You know, if you don't want to be thinking about anything, just focus on your breath. Focus on taking and giving. Because we only have 3.5 days, and to get the most out of it, the more we can, you know, turn our minds inward to the subject, the more benefit we'll get. And, you know, we've all put a lot of effort into getting here, so we might as well make the most of it. So that's why we stay silent. But please get up and enjoy your cup of tea. And I'll see you in 15 minutes. Okay? And you don't have to wait for me. I have to drink my tea. So just go.